Before we start the podcast, we wanted to let you know about WestOS. If you're a teacher or pupil at a school in Scotland, then you now have access to hundreds of quality assured video lessons created by teachers to support your remote learning. You should be able to find WestOS within the app library of Glow, where you can add the tile to your own personal launchpad. Click on the tile and you'll have immediate access to stream lessons in every area of the Scottish curriculum, with video lessons already available for biology at National 5, Higher and Advanced Higher. Now let's get on with the podcast.
That if people disappeared, the planet would do just nicely without us, but that if insects were to disappear, the ecosystems would collapse into chaos, was how he put it, and he was absolutely right.
In this introductory lesson, we'll be taking our first steps into sustainability and interdependence. We'll discuss why insects are so important and consider if Adolf Hitler might just be to blame for their disappearance. And to help make things a little bit more interesting, we are joined by scientist and Times best-selling author Dave Goulson.
My name's Dave Goulson. I'm Professor of Biology at the University of Sussex, and I specialise in bumblebees, really, and more broadly interested in kind of ecology and entomology and saving the planet, I guess.
So, biology, your favourite subject at school, Dave?
Yeah, absolutely. I always loved, even before school, I was into bugs for some reason, just liked collecting caterpillars and trying to rear them up, and had a sort of jam jars all over my bedroom windowsill and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I've just been lucky to make a career in it.
My understanding is that when you were at school, you had a fairly rotund, grumpy, hairy biology teacher, which, if I was totally honest, reminds me of myself a little bit. What was it about biology that captures your imagination?
That's a really good question. I mean, yeah, my Mr. Newton, his name was Isaac, as he was known to us, had an enormous beard, and he stank of pipe smoke the whole time. He was always sucking on his pipe, even though it wasn't lit in the classroom. Anyway, yeah, he wasn't the most inspiring teacher, but I just loved it from the start. It's something about, I mean, it's creatures that, you know, nature, wildlife that I really like. And obviously learning about them in biology was pretty cool, I thought.
In the coming lessons, we're going to start by taking a much closer look at food security, crop protection, biodiversity, and threats to biodiversity. At National 5, we learned that biodiversity meant the total variation that exists among all living things on Earth. All of these living things are dependent on each other, but sometimes we fail to notice what's happening right in front of us.
I remember vividly going on family holidays as a child and driving across Europe. And one of the big memories I've got is every time we stopped the car, we had to clear the windscreen because it would be splattered with bugs and splattered with insects. Myself and my wife were away on a trip last year, and we didn't have to do that. And that struck me as something that was quite odd. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's really worrying, actually, and that's really the only kind of aspect of insect declines that people notice, you know, and then it's only people who are old enough to remember a time. I can remember the same thing, you know, we used to go camping in France every summer, driving around in the car, and the windscreen would just get covered in these dead bugs, and now you can drive for hours, even in a beautiful summer's day, and no bug splats. And there's a lot of scientific evidence, more proper rigorous information suggesting that insect populations are in rapid decline, sadly. There's been some big study. There was a big study from Germany where German kind of insect fanatics have been running these, they're kind of tent-like traps called malaise traps that catch flying insects. And they end up crawling in, falling into a bottle of alcohol. And they've been doing that since 1989. And the daily catch of insects has fallen by 75% since, it's about 27 years. That was when they stopped and analyzed the data. So in really not that long, just over a quarter of a century, Germany seems to have lost three quarters of its flying insects. which is pretty astonishing and you know, should be really worrying. I could tell you about other evidence as well from the UK and elsewhere, but that's perhaps the most dramatic example.
I mean, that surely must be one of the most dramatic extinction events since a meteor struck the Euclid Peninsula and killed off the dinosaurs.
Well, so scientists these days talk about the sixth mass extinction event. And as you say, the last one was 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs got wiped out, and along with a whole bunch of other creatures. You know, there have been five in the historic past for various reasons, but hundreds of millions of years apart generally. This time that this extinction event is unique because it's being caused by a species on the planet. It's being caused by us. It's something, you know, we should be really worried and kind of ashamed of as well. I mean, I think it's awful what we're doing to the planet. You know, that we have no right to exterminate nature, and we are, sadly. You know, if we don't change trajectory, then by the end of this century, we could easily have lost half the species on this planet, which would be an absolute tragedy.
In your book, you make reference to the fact that we could possibly blame Hitler partly for the demise of insects. Can you tell us a little bit more? Why is it Hitler's fault?
Yeah, Hitler. Damn him. I mean, actually, insects have declined for lots of reasons. But a big part of it is the way farming changed. We've gone from a system of farming sort of before the last war. I think 100 years ago, most farms were small with little fields. There was not much mechanization, so everything had to be done by hand. So you couldn't have great big fields. Lots of hedgerows, lots of different crops and crop rotations. And it was all kind of higgledy-piggledy. They would have had things like clover lays and left some land fallow at any one time. It was just very unintensive. Didn't produce as much food. Anyway, the Second World War struck, and Britain was cut off from food supplies. You know, we had to try and ship it in from North America, and there were U-boats in the Atlantic sinking the boats, bringing food over, and food was rationed. Not just during the war, but right through the 50s afterwards. And so government set about introducing policies to make farming more productive, more efficient, to produce more food so that we could be self-sufficient. And so they paid farmers to rip out hedges and make the fields bigger and to mechanize and to start using more fertilizers and pesticides and so on. And so we moved to this system of kind of industrial farming as a direct consequence of the Second World War and obviously Hitler. But the sort of sad thing is we carried on with those policies until the 1990s. So we were still paying farmers to rip out hedges as recently as 1995.
It's worth pointing out at this point that we're starting to see how threats to biodiversity are linked directly into crop protection and food security. And hopefully over the next couple of lessons, you'll start to understand a little bit more about that.
So unfortunately, this kind of intensive farming does produce more food, but it has made the land fairly inhospitable for other forms of life. You know, that there aren't many flowers, and there aren't many places for insects to nest or to hibernate. All there is huge expanses of wheat or oilseed rape. And even if an insect can find something to eat in that landscape, it's going to have to survive being sprayed with pesticides, insecticides designed to kill insects. And so, sadly, 70% of the land is farmland. And if most of that is kind of hostile, then it's not really surprising that wildlife has declined.
At National 5, we would have looked at bioaccumulation, which is, of course, the buildup of a chemical within an organism, particularly in terms of DDT. Am I right in thinking DDT would have been introduced around about the time of the Second World War?
Yeah, so DDT was first used in the Second World War. They started off using it to kill mosquitoes. It was used to try and prevent malaria in the troops fighting in Asia, actually. That was where it was first used. But then it became apparent that it was really good at killing insects, and farmers started using it straight after the war to control crop pests. And it was brilliant to start with. You know, everyone thought this was a kind of wonder, you know, golden bullet, and the crop yields increased. It pretty much wiped out all of the pests. Science seems great, but no one had really anticipated the kind of longer term impacts. As it turns out, DDT is much more persistent in the environment than anyone had anticipated. It lasts for decades and decades, and
that of course increases as you go up the food chain as well.
Yeah, exactly. It concentrates up, and unfortunately, we're quite high up the food chain, along with polar bears and birds of prey and so on. And in fact, it was birds of prey that really showed up some of the worst effects, because the pesticide accumulates, and it lodges in fat, so it lodges in our fat stores and in our livers. Anyway, in birds of prey, it caused eggshell thinning, which meant that the eggs were so delicate that they were usually broken by the birds, by the parents trying to sit on them. And most birds of prey in the world had a massive population dive in the 50s and 60s as a result.
If you have access to the Hodder Gibson Higher Biology 2nd edition textbook, you'll find a good diagram along with lots more information on DDT and the persistence of pesticides on page 242. We will take a much closer look at evolution as we study DNA in the genome in Unit 1. But as we were already chatting, Dave agreed to share a little bit more about his beloved bumblebees and where they came from.
Yeah, so insects are amongst the oldest animals on land. They first appeared best part of 400 million years ago, so long, long before the dinosaurs. And they were the first animals to invent flight. This was before bees existed, but the ancestors of bees evolved flight about 380 million years ago. So they were the first creatures to take to the air on Earth. It's only happened four times, incidentally, the evolution of flight, by the pterosaurs and then birds and eventually bats. But insects were first. Anyway, the first bee appeared about 120 million years ago. They evolved from wasps, and bees are basically kind of wasps turned vegetarian. The ancestor of the bees was, we think, a type of wasp that it was a solitary creature, lived on its own, and it would have made a burrow or some kind of nest and stocked it with paralyzed prey, so probably caterpillars or spiders that it had caught and stung. And then it lays its eggs on the paralyzed prey, and the grubs consume the poor creatures alive. It's pretty gruesome.
It's tasty.
Yeah, lovely. But at some point, about, as I say, 120 million years ago, presumably one of these wasps started supplementing the insects in its nest with pollen, which is a rich source of protein. And eventually it switched to exclusively feeding its offspring on pollen. And that basically was the first bee. And since then, they've been very successful. There are now about 20,000 species of bee in the world. We've got about 270 just in the UK. And this kind of mutualism with flowers is one of the most important processes on the sort of ecological processes on the planet.
A mutualistic relationship is one where both partners benefit. And we'll learn more about mutualism and symbiosis later in Unit 3. But for now, let's go back to Dave and find out a little bit more about the role that insects play in our ecosystems.
This is obviously going to form part of a biology podcast, so it seems natural that at some point we'll talk about sex, and I guess sex is pretty hard if you're a plant.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, animals can run around and look for a mate and spend a lot of time doing that, but if you're a plant that's literally rooted to the ground, then finding and exchanging DNA, exchanging gametes with a partner is pretty challenging. And the early plants tended to just throw their pollen onto the wind. So the pollen is the kind of male gametes, the equivalent of sperm in plants. And to this day, there are still quite a few plants that do that, grasses, coniferous trees. They just produce lots of very fine pollen that blows away on the wind, and they just hope that by pure chance that pollen blows onto a female flower and fertilizes it. But enlisting the help of insects is a much more efficient system. So flowers with colorful petals and nectar awards evolved to attract insects to visit the flower. And the flowers evolve sticky pollen, which sticks on the insects. And then as the insect flies from flower to flower, it accidentally spills a few grains each time it lands on a flower. And that's a much more efficient system than just throwing your pollen onto the wind and hoping that, that luck will take it where you want it to go. And so the plants that evolve flowers that are insect pollinated have themselves been really successful and become the dominant plants on Earth. About 87% of all plant species on the planet depend upon animals to pollinate them, usually insects, very often bees. But there are, we shouldn't forget, there are lots of other insects that are important pollinators too, wasps, beetles, flies, butterflies, moths, and so on. If you go out into a natural ecosystem, most of the plants are insect pollinated, and most of the insects you see, or a great many of them, are pollinators. They're feeding on the nectar and pollen produced by plants in exchange for pollination.
Really, without the insects, life's going to be pretty hard to keep going.
Yeah, not just because of pollination. I mean, insects do a whole bunch of important stuff. They make up the majority of biodiversity on the planet themselves. You know, about 2/3 of all known species, about 1 million species of insects so far discovered, which is about 2/3 of all known species. And they're food for an enormous number of birds, bats, things like frogs and lizards and so on, freshwater fish, all eat insects. And then they're biocontrol agents of crop pests. They recycle dung and they recycle dead bodies and they keep the soil healthy. And they basically do a whole heap of stuff. Which is why we should be really worried that insects are declining, because as an American biologist, E.O. Wilson, who once said that if people disappeared, the planet would do just nicely without us, but that if insects were to disappear, the ecosystems would collapse into chaos, was how he put it, and he was absolutely right.
We've put some of the blame, I guess, on Hitler already, but really, as humans, we're actually pretty stupid in a lot of ways, and a lot of the problems we are causing and continuing to cause, obviously we're recording this remotely because everybody's locked down during the coronavirus, and a lot of people around the country are heading out into their garden if they're lucky enough to have one, and you know, there are some pristine lawns across the UK. It could be argued that lawns in the UK have never looked the way they have during this pandemic. But that's not necessarily a good thing either, is it?
It's not. It's kind of sad that we Brits are a bit obsessed by, you know, trying to recreate a kind of Wimbledon tennis court in our back garden. You know, my dad does it. He spends loads of time mowing up and down in stripes, and he pays a company to come in and put pesticides on to kill the moss and to kill any insects that dare eat the roots of the grass and so on. But unfortunately, you know, that kind of a lawn is actually a pretty desolate place for wildlife. And it could be amazing. So I'm very keen on persuading people to try and mow a bit less. And as soon as you stop mowing, most lawns burst into flower. They've got dandelions and buttercups and daisies and self-heal and speedwell and all sorts of lovely little flowers. Never get a chance to flower because they're having their buds mown off all the time. But many of us unknowingly have basically got a wildflower meadow lurking in our back garden. And if we just relax and stop mowing it, stop putting pesticides on it, stop pouring fertilizer on it, then you've instantly got wildlife habitat. And more broadly, there's huge potential to make our gardens into kind of mini nature reserves. We've got about 500,000 hectares of gardens in the UK, which is a bigger area than all of our nature reserves put together. So we could actually make a good start on trying to halt and reverse these declines of insects and other wildlife by looking after them in our gardens, by pl- planting bee-friendly, butterfly-friendly flowers, by not spraying insecticides, by turning our lawns into wildflower meadows, putting in a pond for aquatic insects, and so on and so on. There's loads of little things that you can do that are the fun, practical projects that will kind of invite nature to come and live with us in our gardens.
There'll be students across the country quoting you now to get out of doing the lawn on Saturday.
Yeah.
One of the other things we were talking about, obviously, about mentioning being in lockdown, anecdotally, certainly from here in the centre of Glasgow, there seems to be a big increase in the number of birds and the amount of bird song, and even actually the number of insects that appear to be about. Now, whether that's because it's a little bit quieter, because we're all going a little bit slower and having time to maybe notice these things, do you think that the kind of massive shutdown that we're seeing and the lack of the drop in transport and all the rest of it, do you think that's going to have a big impact on biodiversity across the country and obviously the planet as well at the moment?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, it does seem to be a good year for wildlife, perhaps because the weather's been pretty good this spring. There's been a lot of bees in my garden, certainly, and butterflies. Whether that's just a chance or whether it's associated with the virus and the fact that we're not driving and so on is unclear. But there's certainly, it will be helping insects to some extent and wildlife. Certainly, for example, we know quite a few insects. We started this conversation talking about bug splats on windscreens. Well, of course, because we're not driving so much, then at least some insects are being saved from being run over, which maybe is a minor benefit. We do know that traffic fumes harm insects. They make it harder for bees to find flowers because they can't smell over the background smell of diesel fumes. But to be honest, I think probably that those effects are quite minor. The really big impacts on insects, the loss of habitat, the intensive farming is carrying on exactly as normal. So although the coronavirus is providing some benefits and more broadly is reducing our carbon dioxide emissions too, which is obviously a good thing for all life on the planet. But actually, I think it may be slightly wishful thinking to think that all of our wildlife is recovering just because we're locked indoors for the moment. Probably not making such a big difference.
No, I don't imagine there's some sort of there's an insect with a big spreadsheet behind them with a curve of road traffic accidents decreasing somewhere. That would make for interesting TV.
Okay, so we might not have found a big benefit about lockdown, but it is good to know there is some good news for insects this year. Within Unit 3, we'll look at social behaviour and social insects, where animals have a society in which only some individuals contribute reproductively. And Dave explains a little bit more about this and whereabouts on the planet we can find bumblebees.
We have 20,000 species of bee on the planet and about 270 in the UK. They're enormously diverse. There are honeybees and bumblebees, stingless bees, carpenter bees, cuckoo bees, mason bees, mining bees, sweat bees, all sorts of different types of bee. The majority of them are solitary creatures. So their ancestors, the first bee, would have been a solitary creature, by which I mean the female makes her own nest. She lives on her own. But some bees later on evolved to these really complicated social lives where they live in big colonies. The honeybee that we get honey from is the best known example, where the colony consists of a huge group of daughters of the queen devoting themselves to looking after the queen. And she's the only one that produces eggs. The workers are more or less sterile. Their job is to gather food and look after the brood and look after mum. And occasionally during the year that they might produce new queens. And males who only have one purpose, which is to mate with the new queens. They don't do any work. They don't defend the nest. And they're extraordinary and fascinating things, social insect colonies. They're mainly found, social insects, in one group of insects, the Hymenoptera, they're called, which includes the ants and wasps and bees. And, of course, all three of those have species that are social that live in these big colonies. And all of them have the same structure with a queen who produces the offspring, and all the workers in both ants, wasps and bees are always female. What else can I tell you about bees? It's hard to know where to stop and start. So although the first bees were probably evolved in warmer climates, my favourite bees, the ones I specialise in, are bumblebees, and they're big furry insects adapted to living in cold climates. So most insects generally are more abundant and diverse in terms of numbers of species in warmer climates, but bumblebees are different. If you look at their distributions globally, most of them live in cool temperate climates and in the mountains, in the Himalayas and in the Alps and the Rockies, and they live right up into the Arctic Circle. And the way they manage to do that is by being, they produce heat internally. They are essentially warm-blooded, which is very unusual for insects. They generate their own heat from their flight muscles, and they keep that heat in with the fur. And being big, it's easier. They have a smaller surface area to volume ratio than say, a fly or smaller insects. And so a bumblebee can fly around inside the Arctic Circle when the air temperature might be as low as 0 degrees centigrade, but the internal temperature of the bee needs to be at least 30 degrees centigrade for them to stay in the air, because if they're not that warm, they can't flap their wings fast enough. So it's pretty remarkable that this little insect can maintain a body temperature 30 degrees higher than the air temperature it's flying in. So basically, bumblebees are specialists in living in cold, wet places like Britain and even further north. One consequence of their having specialised in living in cool places is they're going to be really hard hit by climate change, sadly.
And the bee you're talking about in the Arctic, that, am I right in thinking that's the Bombus polaris?
Very good. You've done your homework. Yeah.
My homework, yeah. Like all good teachers, I've done my homework. And basically, the Bombus polaris really is a hairy bee, large bee with a bit of a sting, a bit like Isaac, your old biology teacher then. so maybe he inspired that love of bumblebees from an early age.
Yeah, I've never thought of that. That's an interesting idea.
One of the facts that again, I think possibly came from your book was, you know, if a man used up the same number of calories found in a Mars bar in about an hour, a man-sized bumblebee, which is quite a thought, would burn the same calories in about 30 seconds, which is an incredible kind of thought.
Yeah, they have one of the highest metabolic rates of any known organism. You know, they're flapping their wings 200 times a second. They're burning calories at a phenomenal rate, which means they're really dependent on being able to find lots of nectar, because that's what fuels all of this. That's the sugar in nectar is what keeps bees in the air, essentially. So if they can't find enough flowers, they're very vulnerable, because if they run out of sugar, they run out of energy, they then can't fly, and they're in big trouble at that point, because then they can't get to flowers to replenish their reserves.
And how do they find these flowers, Dave?
Well, so flowers do their best to be found. The plant wants to be visited by insects. So it produces scent, it produces colourful big petals. The pollen is also a reward to attract insects. And at the same time, because it's so important...
Sounds like they're getting ready for a date.
Yeah, well, they are, you know, because ultimately the purpose of flowers is to have sex as well. And because the bees also need to find the flowers, because it's about food. So they've evolved good vision, which helps them see those colourful petals, very acute sense of smell so that they can sniff out the flowers. They've evolved adaptations to help them gather the food. So some species of bee have very long tongues that help them to reach nectar in deep flowers. They have special combs on their legs for extracting the pollen from the flowers. And they've also crucially evolved quite big brains, which enable them to remember which types of flower provide the most reward and to memorize where those flowers are in the landscape so that they can find their way back to the same patch of flowers over and over again, which is something most insects would be absolutely hopeless at. But bees have very good learning abilities and navigational abilities which make them kind of among the intellectual giants of the insect world, I guess.
But they, am I right in thinking bees also have stinky feet?
Yeah, so I noticed something years ago. I was watching some bees in a patch of flowers, and I noticed that they don't visit every flower. They fly from flower to flower, but they'll often approach a flower and veer away at the last second. And I thought that was quite interesting. I actually spent about 5 years studying that with a PhD student of mine, Jane Stout, who's now a professor in Trinity College Dublin, actually. But anyway, and what we basically discovered was that they sniff the flower before they land. And if they can smell the smelly footprint of a recent previous visitor, they don't bother landing because that previous bee will have taken the nectar and the pollen. So it just saves them time visiting an empty flower. And these smelly footprints, they're not left behind deliberately. It's actually all insects are covered in kind of oils on their cuticle, which help to waterproof them, just as our skin has oils on it. And in exactly the same way as we leave a fingerprint on a glass when we put it down, bees, when they land on a flower, they leave behind a little oily footprint, which can be used by subsequent bees as a signal that that flower is empty. So it's kind of cool, and it's all part of the strategies that bees have evolved to kind of maximize their efficiency to make them very good at gathering food.
So there we go, a bit of an insight into Unit 3. And over the next few lessons, we'll be looking a wee bit further into food security, crop protection, and biodiversity. Before we let Dave go, we thought we'd ask him why someone might be interested in studying biology a little bit further.
I wouldn't have done anything else. I love my job. I'm really lucky because it was basically my childhood hobby, chasing around after insects, and I somehow persuaded people to pay me to do it. And I, you know, it's not necessarily easy to make a career in research, but it can be done, and it's great fun. And also, if specifically insects, there is so much that we don't know about them that yet to be found out. We haven't even named most of them yet. You know, we think probably we've named about 20% of all the insects in the world. So we know nothing about all those ones that have yet to be discovered. There's bound to be all sorts of weird and wonderful life histories and behaviors and appearances and just all waiting to be discovered. So I think that's pretty damn cool. And also, of course, as we've been talking about, insects are hugely important. We need to make sure that there are enough insects into the future for them to deliver all these ecosystem services, things like pollination, that we depend upon. So there's a very kind of practical reason to study them, and which is to make sure we can look after them better. So one way or another, I think there's plenty of scope in the future for people to make careers in insects, in entomology, in ecology.
Excellent. Dave Goulson, thank you very, very much for joining us and for your input for all our students.
My pleasure. It's been fun.